The sound may be just a little bit louder though with this thing on, but when I step out from away from here, it'll be better, be heard better. We are on page 122, talking about the return of Jesus Christ, study number 18. Gonna There we go. Better bring the high pitch part down just a little bit. 122. I'll give you a second to get there. We're going to be in Daniel chapter 9 a bit here at the beginning. We're going to discuss the time frame between the rapture and the revelation. Or as we often say, the rapture and the second coming. However, the way that we are presenting this or looking at this, we see the second coming as the rapture and the return, or revelation as he calls it. So letter A here says, the Old Testament prophetic book of Daniel teaches there will be a 7-year period between the two phases of the second coming of Christ. Daniel chapter 9, verse 24 says, 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins. Come on. And to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. This speaks of a time or a period of 70 weeks. He says at the beginning there, 70 weeks are determined upon thy people. Now we're going to look at this a little bit here. It says in Daniel chapter 29, not chapter 29. If the book of Daniel has 29 chapters in your Bible, throw it away. It's not a Bible. It's not supposed to have 29 chapters in the book of Daniel. All right. Daniel chapter 9, verse number 25 says, now therefore, or know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the Prince, shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street should be built again and the wall, even in troublous times. Everybody get what that is? 7 weeks, 62 weeks, 64, 24 to 60, 62 plus 7, 69 weeks. You got it. All right. It's kind of interesting math there. Oh yeah, by the way, I think we have some leftover donuts out here if anybody wants any. I think we did the same thing this morning. All right, so it says that these weeks are in fact heptads, or 7-year periods of time. And I grabbed another passage that wasn't in your study and threw it in here so that we could just kind of, for understanding and use of this word week. In Genesis chapter 29, verse number 27 through 30, it says, fulfill her week, and we will give thee this also for the service which thou shalt serve with me yet 7 other years. Okay, does that make sense? This week that Laban is speaking about to Jacob is a week of 7 years, not days. Okay, so he says, and Jacob did so and fulfilled her week, and he gave him Rachel, his daughter, to wife also. And Laban gave to Rachel, his daughter, Bilhah, his handmaid, to be her maid. And he went in also unto Rachel and loved also Rachel more than Leah, and served him yet 7 other years. So this is, he ended up serving, like, I think it was like 21 years total. What's that? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He's like, I'll serve for your daughter Rachel, and then he gets Leah, and he's like, what in the world? What have you done to me? And he's like, it's too late now. Now you got to serve for Rachel again. But the idea here, the reason we're going to this passage is he speaks of a week there, and he's speaking there of a week of not days, but years. And so, from the going forth of the commandment to rebuild Jerusalem to the Messiah, or Christ, being cut off, would be 69 weeks. And this is from 445 B.C. to 30 A.D. This is 69 times 7 is 483 Jewish years. Okay, don't misunderstand that to be solar years. Solar years, it's 475. He's speaking, a Jew speaking, or the Lord speaking through a Jew to the Jews, you know, to the Jews, right? And then about the Jews, yeah. So, obviously, he's going to use their calendar, which is a lunar calendar, the Jewish calendar. So, 483 years ends up being 475 years in our calendar. So, when you do the math and you're like, wait a minute. How does that work? 483 years from the going forth of the commandment to rebuild Jerusalem to the Messiah. Well, wait a minute. We're missing, you know, like a dozen years there, almost. It's like, what's going on? Well, it's because our solar years are different than the Jewish years. So this this part has been fulfilled. First of all, we had that. The commandment to rebuild Jerusalem. Does anybody know who gave the commandment to rebuild the city? There are actually two kings that did so. There's one that specifically... there's one that says to go and rebuild the temple, and there's one that says to go and rebuild Jerusalem. And now I can't remember which one said which, but I remember who they were. There was Artaxerxes, and there was Cyrus. Cyrus was actually mentioned, like, long before he was born. God said that Cyrus would give the commandment from God. But the thing is, like, down lower than it should be, I think. Oh, well. We'll fix it later. Maybe we'll just... So... From that time, that commandment that was given to the time that Jesus was cut off, crucified, there's 483 years. Now, that leaves us with one more week. We have 69 weeks. Out of those 70 weeks has been used up, and there's one more week. And Daniel chapter 9, verse 27 speaks of how that week is going to begin. And, or it says it's yet to begin. It says, and he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. And in the midst of the week, he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. For the overspreading of abominations, he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation. And that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. So notice here that between 25 and 27, of course we had verse 26 as well that we didn't really discuss, but between 25 and 27, it just kind of discusses more, verse 26 kind of discusses more about what happens when the Messiah is cut off and then there's a flood into the city, meaning a flood of people. They take out basically AD 70, which happened after the Messiah was cut off at AD 30 roundabout. AD 70 is when Rome came in and invaded Israel or Jerusalem and destroyed the city, burned down the temple, and, you know, just as Jesus said, there was not one stone left upon another. They just took it out. And so, anyways, this passage, between verse 26 and 27, there's a gap in the prophecy. There's something that happens in between there. And we're in that gap right now. We're waiting for the one who is to come to confirm the covenant with many. And that covenant will be, as you'll find other passages dealing with it, it'll be a peace treaty. It'll be a covenant that will ensure world peace, especially for Israel and those around them. But he's going to do that for a week. He's going to confirm the covenant for 1 week, and then he's going to like stop the whole thing, mess it all up right in the middle of that week. So that 1 week is going to be a 7 year week, just like this other 69 weeks. But it says the present day of grace began at the cutting off of the Messiah, and God's prophetic clock stopped at the end of the 69th week, when the Messiah was cut off or crucified. The final 7 years of Daniel's prophecy will begin with the rapture. Christians will be caught up and will not be involved in any of the events which will transpire during the, or on the earth during this period. I'm going to make a correction there. I don't believe that that 70th week begins with the rapture. The 70th week begins with that covenant. Okay? The rapture may happen the same day as that covenant happens, or it may happen like days before, months before, a year before. I don't know. But I do know that before the covenant happens, the rapture takes place, because it's the time, it's that's the timing of the way all of that works. So the way that when you look at the beginning of, or the continuation of the 70 weeks, the focus of God comes off of the Gentile nations primarily. Doesn't mean that he doesn't focus on them at all, but it comes off of the Gentile nations primarily, and it goes back on to Israel. And in fact, really, we already kind of see the world focus is moving toward Israel. What is it that everybody wants to know? Well, not everybody, but a lot of people want to know about the presidential candidates. They want to know, what do you stand with Israel? Where do you stand concerning Israel? Are you going to maintain Israel as an ally? Are we going to take care of Israel? Are we going to help them? Israel's a big deal. Israel always has been a big deal and always will be a big deal. But Israel's not the primary focus right now in God's economy. Right now in God's economy, the Gentile nations are the primary focus, and more specifically the church that he's building is his primary focus. I've got an eyelash in my eyeball. Does not feel good. So here the following diagram shows how the main events will occur during this time frame. He shows today, and then the rapture, the 70th week, and then the millennium there, with the judgment seat and the marriage supper happening sometime during that 70th week. That judgment seat being the time that the Christians stand before the Lord for their judgment. Not judgment to find out whether they're going to heaven or hell, but judgment to find out what rewards they'll receive for the deeds that they've done in the body. And then the marriage supper of the Lamb is the last thing that happens right before Revelation chapter 19. Well, in Revelation chapter 19 it happens, but it happens right before the return of Christ in Revelation 19, where he comes back riding on a white horse, not to be confused with the guy riding on a white horse at the beginning of Revelation. The guy at the beginning of Revelation riding on a white horse is the Antichrist, and he will have a crown and a bow and all of that, and he will conquer through peace with his bow, with no arrow, conquer through peace, and then he has a crown given to him, so he looks like the Lord. But when the Lord returns, he'll be unmistakable. He'll have many crowns, and return with a sword proceeding out of his mouth, and he'll conquer with the sword, and it will be a great battle, as you'll see in Revelation chapter 19. You can see all of that. So, we'll look at what happens in between here. First of all, the judgment seat of Christ. According to 1 Corinthians 4:5, it says, "Therefore, judge nothing before the time until the Lord come, who will bring to light the hidden things of darkness, and will make manifest the counsels of the hearts, and then shall every man have praise of God." So, says here, this solemn event will occur at the time when the Lord comes. Very good. immediately after the rapture. So this then the next thing here is Romans 14:10 says, "But why dost thou judge thy brother, or why dost thou set it not thy brother? For we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ." So who will take part in this particular judgment? It does say all.
What's the context?
Who is Paul speaking to? I mean, we can say that in a general sense, we will all, everyone, saved and lost, will stand before the judgment seat of Christ, because his judgment seat is his judgment seat. But he's speaking specifically there to whom? Brethren. Yeah. He's speaking to to Christians. Yes, that, and
so I want to make sure that people understand that I do make a point to tell people, look, we will all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. I believe that people that take this and say that it's only Christians that stand before the judgment seat of Christ, and there's some other judgment seat that lost people stand before, it's the same judgment seat. It's just a different time. We all stand before the judgment seat of Christ, period. But the point is, even Christians will stand before God's judgment seat. We just stand before it in a different time and in a different way, or for a different reason. So the next passage here, verse 12 of the same chapter, says, "So then every one of us shall give account of himself before God." So this says, what will we have to do at this judgment? Give an account. 2 Corinthians 5:10, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad." What aspect of our lives will come under scrutiny at this judgment? Things done in the body. Very good. All right, 1 Corinthians 3, verses 9 through 15. By the way, let's see. I'll just go through what he's going through here, and we'll deal with it then. "For we are laborers together with God, your God's husbandry, your God's building, according to the grace of God, which is given unto me. As a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another buildeth thereon. But let every man take heed how he buildeth thereupon. For other foundation can no man lay than that is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now if any man build upon this foundation gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, stubble, every man's work shall be tried, or shall be made manifest. For the day shall declare it, because it shall be revealed by fire. And the fire shall try every man's work of what sort it is. If any man's work abide, which he hath built thereupon, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss. But he himself shall be saved, yet so as by fire." All right, verse 9, it says, "The church at Corinth is called God's building." Very good. "The foundation of which is Jesus Christ." Number 2 here, "The Lord is very intense in how we build this foundation." I underlined the word "how" because he's not necessarily saying what we build on the foundation. He gives us the building blocks, so to speak, the building materials. But he says to take heed how we build on it. According to verse 12, these works are likened to gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, and stubble. Right. So the fire of this judgment will try the works of every Christian that says, according to verse 15, is it possible for a Christian who has never acceptably served the Lord to be lost and cast into hell? He says, will it be possible for a Christian who has never acceptably served the Lord to be lost and cast into hell? The answer is no. Now, let me back up for a second there.
a Christian who has never acceptably served the Lord might not be a Christian.
Okay, so I
don't want to like take too much time to jump into all of that. I'm not saying that he is not a Christian, but I'm saying he might not be a Christian. So
I don't want to emphasize that point because I don't want to give anyone false hope or false security. But at the same time, I also don't want to give someone a false doubt either. Okay, according to verse 14, what will the Christian who has acceptably served the Lord receive? A reward. Very good. All right, so the Bible speaks of these rewards as crowns. There are five crowns we can receive as a reward for our for our life as a Christian. I like what he does here, but I don't
want to like limit this into this little category here, because
I've heard people preach about the five crowns and all of that kind of thing, but you know, it also speaks of you know, people being a crown. In fact, what it says, for what is our hope or joy or crown of rejoicing? Are not even ye in the presence of our Lord Jesus Christ at his coming? So he's literally saying here that the Thessalonians are his crown. His crown of rejoicing. His hope, his joy, his crown of rejoicing. But here he uses this passage to say that this is the soul winner's crown. And, you know, I mean, sure. Exciting. I'm fine with that. But at the same time, I don't want to get, you know, this isn't about like, hey, let's go win some crowns, guys, so we can put some crowns on our head.
You know, have so many crowns on our head in heaven that we
have to walk around with a hunchback because the crowns are so heavy. That's not the point. We're not doing this for because we're greedy of filthy lucre because we want reward for it. However, God will reward us. But we don't do what we do because of the reward. So he says here that this is a crown of rejoicing. And then the next one here, James 1:12, he says, blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. So this is the faithful Christian's crown, called the crown of life. Very good. 2 Timothy 4, verse 8, henceforth, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give to me at that day, and not to me only, but unto all them also that love his appearing. This here says, this is the crown for those who love and look for the Lord's return, and it is called the crown of righteousness. Very good. The crown of righteousness. You know what? I just read that wrong. He says, for those who live and look for the Lord's return. I said love and look for the Lord's return, which is more accurate to the passage there, because it says them also that love his appearing. So, anyways, 1 Corinthians 9:25. Hey, we might get through this today. Praise the Lord. 1 Corinthians 9:25 says, and every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. So this is the crown for the victorious Christian, and it is called the incorruptible crown. You know, like I said before, these crowns, I mean, I don't even necessarily see a difference between all of them. I think that you know, we're crowned as a fact of being faithful Christians. What's that? Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and there's other like lists of crowns or names for crowns. I've seen, you know, some people say five, some people say seven, so, you know, and and whatever, you know, you have the martyr's crown and all this other stuff. But, all right, 1 Peter 5:4 says, and when the chief shepherd shall appear, he shall ye shall receive a crown of glory that fadeth not away. This crown is for the faithful pastor. He is speaking to pastors there or elders. So, and it's called the crown of glory. Does that mean that only pastors can get that crown? I think the crown thing, here's the thing. This is a really small little section of this whole study, and it's really not a significant part of the return of Christ necessarily. It is, we'll get a crown and so forth. But I like, as the song says, and I think I have the song right here actually, in my Bible. The one that's got like 100 verses to it. The bride eyes not her garment, but her dear bridegroom's face. I will not gaze at glory, but on my King of grace. Not at the crown he giveth, but on his pierced hand. The Lamb is all the glory of Emmanuel's Lamb. I think that puts it very well. That when the Lord returns, you and I are not going to be concerned with what crowns we received. We're going to be excited about the fact that my Jesus has come to get me. And I'm going to be with him forever now. And, I mean, that's the exciting thing about the return of Christ. The crowns are just kind of like, you know, well done thou good and faithful servant. And he gives us the crown. And then you'll see though in another passage, just a few minutes later, or just a short time later, what are we doing? We're casting our crowns at his feet, giving them right back. It's like, hey, you know, I mean, if it weren't for you, I wouldn't have them to begin with. So, or we wouldn't have them to begin with. So that's a very important thing to consider. So the marriage supper of the Lamb, which is interesting because we're dealing with the Lamb on Wednesday night, or not the Lamb, but the bride on Wednesday nights. But the marriage supper of the Lamb here, according to Ephesians 5:22-32, and it says, wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church. He is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, and that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives, or as their own bodies. He that loveth him, loveth his wife, there we go, loveth his wife, loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it even as the Lord of the church. For we are members of his body, and of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. So the relationship between the Lord Jesus Christ and his churches is likened to that between a husband and wife. Right. Very good. According to 2 Corinthians 11:2, which says, For I am jealous over you with godly jealousy, for I have espoused you, the one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. According to this passage, the church at Corinth was espoused to one husband, Christ. Man, this is like really neat how I did not plan for these studies to like overlap the way that they have. But it's great that our Sunday school study and our Wednesday night study have overlapped, and we're dealing with like the same passages, the same statements. I mean, it's like, wow. Because I'm looking at it and I'm like, man, what? Didn't we just talk about this? Wednesday night. So John 3:29 and Revelation 22:17. Or no. Yeah, 22:17. Let's see. We'll read those real quick here and then look at the statement. It says, he that hath the bride is the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom, which standeth and heareth him, rejoiceth greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. This my joy therefore is fulfilled. Chapter 22:17 of Revelation says, and the Spirit and the bride say, come, and let him that heareth say, come, And let him that is athirst come, and whosoever will, let him take of the water of life freely. But here it says, one of the metaphors used of the true New Testament churches is the bride of Christ. Bride of Christ. That fits though, doesn't it? All right. Revelation 19, verses 7 through 9. Let us be glad and rejoice and give honor to him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come, and his wife hath made herself ready, and to her was granted that she should be arrayed in fine linen, clean and white, for the fine linen is the righteousness of the saints. And he saith unto me, write, blessed are they which are called unto the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he saith unto me, these are the true sayings of God. So, the union of bride and bridegroom occurs at the rapture, and the wedding celebration is referred to in Revelation 19, 7 through 9 as the marriage supper of the Lamb. Very good. All right, Daniel's 70th week. So now we've talked about what's going on with us in heaven during that time. Now we're going to talk about what is happening here on earth. While the judgment seat of Christ and the marriage supper of the Lamb are taking place in heaven, an entirely different scene will unfold on earth. The book of Revelation gives details of the events of this seven-year period prophesied by Daniel, chapter 6 through 18 in particular. This isn't speaking of the book of Daniel. That's speaking of Revelation. Daniel doesn't have 18 chapters. But chapters 6 through 18 of Revelation are dealing with this seven-year period that is spoken of in Daniel chapter 9. Does that make sense? It is a horrifying prophecy of coming war, rebellion, catastrophe, and desolation. It is called by several names, including Isaiah 2:12-22. Talks about it as the day of the Lord. Very good. I'm not going to read all of that right now because we're going to try to get on through this study today. Yes, it speaks of it as the day of the Lord, Isaiah 2:12-22. And then Deuteronomy 4:30. I'll go ahead and read it. And Revelations 17:4 says, when thou art in tribulation and all these things are come upon thee, even in the latter days, if the Lord turn, or if thou turn to the Lord thy God and shalt be obedient unto his voice. Then he says in Revelation 7:14, and I said unto him, sir, thou knowest, and he said unto me, these are they which have come out of great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. So this time is called a time of tribulation. And then Revelation 6:17, for the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? It is the great day of wrath. And then he says here, Christians will not pass through any of this period. How do we know this? Now, let me back up for just a second first, before we go on. Please don't misunderstand and think that Christians will not go through tribulation. Christians have gone through tribulation since there have been Christians on the earth. Okay? When we're talking about this 70th week, this period of tribulation, we're not talking about tribulation like the Christians go through today. We're talking about tribulation that comes not from your fellow man, but tribulation that comes from God himself. And Christians will never go through tribulation that comes from God himself. And when we say tribulation in that sense, we're not talking about a hard time. We're talking about God absolutely destroying the earth.
Absolutely destroying. Death, plague, famine, pestilence, which I've already said plague, economic, like, destruction. Now, some of those things have happened and will happen before this period of great tribulation. However, during that time, the world will be run by the Antichrist, and God will be pouring out his wrath upon the earth. Every example in the Bible that we see God pouring out his wrath on either the whole earth or an area of the earth, every time he takes first his people out. We see
what? The flood with Noah? What happened?
The boat, right?
He took Noah and his family out. And they escaped that wrath of God. And then in Sodom and Gomorrah, we had Lot and his wife and children. What did God do? He took them out of the city. Now, his wife disobeyed and was turned to a pillar of salt. But he took them out of the city before the destruction. He didn't begin destroying it and then take him out in the middle of the destruction. He didn't destroy the city and then take him out at the end because he made it through. He took him out before the destruction, before he poured out his wrath. So, Jeremiah 30, verse 7 says, alas for that great day, or I'm sorry, alas for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. This is the time of whose trouble? Jacob's trouble. That's the question he gives. It will be a time of Jacob's trouble. It is specific, and it has specifically to do with the Jews and the nation of Israel. As you notice in Daniel chapter 9, verse 24, it says, thy people and thy holy city. This is speaking of Jacob and the people of Israel, the Jews and the nation of Israel. Revelation 3:10 says, because thou hast kept the word of my patience, I will keep thee from the hour of temptation which shall come upon all the world and to try them that dwell upon the earth. So he says that the Lord's promise to his faithful church at Philadelphia was that he would working ahead there. Revelation 3:10. He's going to keep them from the hour of temptation which shall come upon all the world. 1 Thessalonians 5:9. For God hath not appointed us to wrath, but to obtain salvation by our Lord Jesus Christ. Our salvation through Jesus Christ assures us that we are not appointed to wrath. And this, I put a note here, specifically speaking God's wrath. Okay? The wrath of man will still come upon us at times as that, you know, as they see fit. So according to Luke 21, verses 34 through 36, it says, and take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness and cares of this life, and so that day come upon you unawares. Now I'm like selecting stuff here. So that day come upon you unawares, as a snare shall it come upon them that dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch ye therefore, and pray always, that ye may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass, and stand before the Son of Man. Christians are to be ready at all times, for the rapture is and always has been imminent. It could happen at any time. According to 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 and 8, it says, let no man deceive you by any means, for that the day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. And then shall that wicked be revealed, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth, and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. He says here that there will be the revealing of the man of sin at the commencement of this 7-year period. Let's see here. He says this person is most often referred to as the Antichrist. He is the devil incarnate. See 1 John 2:18, which says, little children, it is the last time. As ye have heard that Antichrist shall come, even now are there many Antichrists, whereby we know that it is the last time. Let me back up for a second, though. He says that day shall not come except there first come a falling away and that man of sin be revealed. I've mentioned this before, and hopefully you caught it and you remembered it. But I'm going to say it again. that day that's being spoken of is not the rapture. That day is the day of the Lord, which begins at the beginning of the tribulation and goes through the millennial kingdom. So that day, or that 7-year period, does begin, or it comes, after the man of sin is revealed, and after the falling away. But it's not, that does not mean that the rapture doesn't happen until that point. The day of the Lord begins at that point. So the rapture may happen the same day, it may happen before it. That's the thing about the rapture, is it is imminent.
It is at any time.
And so this falling away and this man of sin being revealed, it is pouring down all of a sudden out there. This takes place at the beginning, or at the inception, or the outset of the day of the Lord, which begins the 70th week of Daniel. Everybody's windows up? All right. That's hail. That looks like some hail down out there. I don't know, maybe it's just huge raindrops. I don't know. I never have been able to look out the back window and see the rain coming down, because we had that frosted window there before. So now it's going to distract me. All right, where are we at here? Letter D. According to Revelation chapter 12, verses 9 and 12, which say, "And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and the angels were cast out with him. Therefore rejoice, ye heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil is come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time." I love this kind of weather. It's wonderful. Especially when you look out and it's bright and the rain's coming down. It's not like gloomy. That's awesome. Praise the Lord. All right. See, I told you I'd get distracted there. So who will be cast down to the earth? Satan shall be cast down. Will be cast down to the earth. The midpoint of this 7-year period. That's not speaking of the man of sin. The man of sin is the Antichrist. He's there at the beginning. Satan comes right in the middle and he's like, all right, it's time to take over. And he didn't do a very good job, but anyhow. Daniel 12:1 says, "And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be in that time, there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time, and at that time thy people shall be delivered, everyone that shall be found written in the book." So here he says, there then will come upon the earth a time such as never was since there was a nation. I'll have to like fix that and send him an email. So, hey, buddy. Mm-hmm. Matthew 24, verses 15-24. we'll not read all of that for sake of time, because we're going to try to get through the rest of this. But verse 21 we'll read, though, because it's where our question comes from. It says, "For then shall there be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be." This awful time is called the Great Tribulation. Okay, then Matthew 24, verses 29-30. "Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken, and
Then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. So the second coming, not the rapture, but the second coming of Christ to the earth occurs at the end of the great tribulation, after the tribulation of those days. Oh, immediately after the tribulation of those days. There we go. At the end is when he returns to stay for the millennium, which we talk about really fast here. Following the return of Christ in glory, he will judge the nations. Very good. And so the Son of Man, when the Son of Man shall come in his glory and all the holy angels with him, he shall sit, then shall he sit upon the throne of his glory, and therefore, and before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth the sheep from the goats, or his sheep from his goats.
According to Joel 3, verses 12 through 16, which you've already read, this great judgment will take place in the valley of Jehoshaphat. Very good. According to Revelation 20, verses 2 and 3, Satan will be bound for how long? 1,000 years. And then according to verse 4, Christ will reign on earth for how long? 1,000 years. This is specifically for that period of time. He'll reign forever and ever, but on earth for 1,000 years, because after that point, earth is done away with and there's a new heaven and a new earth. All right, so according to Isaiah 2, verse 4, the millennium will be a time of peace. Very good. No war. And we lost our connection. That's okay, because we're probably not going to read any of the others here for a moment. According to Isaiah, I think we only lost the connection between the iPhone and the projector, so that's okay. We're still streaming. So according to Isaiah 11, verses 1 through 10, which you've already read, hopefully, the millennium will be a time of judgment, righteousness. I said justice, being full of the knowledge of the Lord, a time of rest. What's that? I want extra credit, though. Yeah. according to Zechariah 14:16, the millennium will be a time of worship and feasting. You can't leave the feasting out, bro. You gotta have the feasting. Alright, for further studies on these fascinating areas, please ask me for more information. There are many books available today, but not all can be fully recommended. And then you try to commit to memory, Titus 2 verses 11 through 13. I have a book on the book of Revelation. It's a good book written by David Cloud. I have a bunch of cool notes that I wrote in it too that you could take a look at. But if you're ever studying through the book of Revelation and you want to like do a deeper study, that book would be recommended. It's like that big. What's that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, those I don't fully recommend, but yeah. Oh, okay. Well, we've got like a whole bookshelf of them back there, but anyways. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, I've got a gray and red one that's real thick, spiral bound, that's got some good stuff on Revelation. And I've got a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff in the study materials folder on my Dropbox that you can look at. Any questions or comments on this subject? Getting kicked in the ribs by a baby.